From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the films receiving a lot of attention already at Sundance this year is Will Allen's documentary, Holy Hell. It's his journey into and out of a cult, basically. And most everyone agrees at this point, this group he joined as an aimless 22-year-old turned out to be a cult. And the signs were probably there all along, but what's really interesting is what it is that draws people to groups like this. As you can imagine, it's complicated. And as he explores in his film, Allen and the 150 people who were part of this group were looking for a community and spiritual enlightenment. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what happens to turn good intentions into something else? And what happens when you realize you have to leave? We're talking about Holy Hell today, after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a chilling moment in Will Allen's new documentary, Holy Hell, premiering at the Sundance Film Festival this year. Christopher Johnston, one of the former members of a group called the Buddha Field, is explaining basically how a cult works. He talks about the social interplay between a master and a disciple, how over time your own beliefs become subsumed by the ideas of this charismatic person, and Johnston says you subjugate your own best interests. I would have killed or died for him, Johnston says. And the film is about Will Allen's 22-year journey into and out of this group and the powerful draw of a mysterious man known as Michelle. All the signs of a cult were probably there all along, the extreme adoration of a paranoid leader, detachment from family, demonizing those who leave. But in those early idealistic days where the motives seemed pure, no one sees it coming. As one group member says in the film, we figured if this was a cult, it was a really good one. Today in the program, we're back in Park City at the community radio station KPCW talking about Holy Hell, which premiered on Monday. It's showing four more times here in the festival, including a screening in Salt Lake City, and we'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. Will Allen is director and producer of the film, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Will Allen, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
Christopher Johnston is with us. I mentioned the name there. Member of the Buddha Field for 16 years. After leaving, he began working on a master's degree in social communication. He's doing a research project using this group as a case study. And welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
So I want to, we'll start with you. Is it true that in 2012 you came to the Sundance Film Festival and that's when the idea of making a film with all of this film that you had started? Is that right?
That is true. Yes, I had been to Sundance before. And in 2012, my partner at the time said, you know, you have to go to Sundance and just come out. Just come out and say you were in a cult for 20 years, but you're really a filmmaker. And I was like, well, I can't do that. But I did come with my, you know, open and wanting to see what the film community was like here because I'd been so gone for so long. And I was so moved and inspired by all the films and the filmmakers and the community as well. Yeah. Really supportive artists, really passionate. And so that was all the stuff I was missing since I left my group. I had nothing. And I was trying to find out where I belonged, and I found it here. And that's when I decided. It literally came to me like, I want to tell an honest, real, truthful story without lies. You know, so many stories are deceptive, and most of my films during that period were only covering half of the truth. And so that's when I embarked. I had 10 days to apply for a grant from Sundance, and I ran home and interviewed people and put together something, and that's when it started.
You say in the film that this realization sort of dawns on you, it comes to you that this was your voice. Mm-hmm. It was interesting how late in the process he seems to have come to you that you had all this tape, you had all this film, and that it wouldn't have occurred to you to make this film until a little bit later, I think, is interesting.
Well, when I left, I wanted nothing to do with my past. The only way I could make sense out of it was to go and create new memories and go and do my life the way I wanted to do it and live my desires as bad as they were. Yeah. And as, you know, I didn't get to do any of that during those 22 years. And so I need to find myself again. And I did. But I was still lost during that period. I was very PTSD from what had happened. I couldn't make sense out of it. We all talked ourselves into circles around it. We figured it all out, but it was no relief from it. So, yes.
Let me, one of the big questions I think that you really get at in the film, and it's almost like this theme, at least initially, is what it is that people want out of life. Like, what are the biggest existential questions possible? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're asking yourself as a 22-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. You wanted to know everything. You wanted to know the truth about the mystery of the.
What happens when we die? Why? You know, right. Religions, they all say something. Yeah. But what really happens? You know, what's really going on here?
Yeah.
I know it's not any of that stuff I had learned as a child, so I wanted to find that out. But it was the 80s. You know, we didn't have the internet. We weren't able to Google everything. And so when I stumbled upon something that was offering this mystery of the key to life, I was very interested.
Christopher Johnston, let me ask you about that too. Did you have these same kinds of questions? Is this part of the thing that brings you into a group like this? Was that idea that there is a mystery maybe? Maybe there's a secret that will be revealed. Is that part of the draw?
Well, that's certainly part of it. And a researcher, I can't remember his first name now, last name Perloff, had a fantastic publication on persuasion. And one of the things he talks about, the reason people join groups like this is basically it either offers a loving home, you know, a community that you can fit into. There's massive social rewards with it. Just the simple religiously reasons for living, because it organizes your moral life. So now I, as a member, I have direction and I have a moral compass that as a young man at 19, I hadn't formed fully yet. And then lastly, there's what you were alluding to, which is supernatural powers.
Yeah.
It's the idea that men can be gods and that they can somehow, you know.
Well, I knew we were godlike. I know we're all godlike. What does that mean? And it was very interesting because when I first got there, the attributes, as it was told to me, the attributes of God are these wonderful attributes. Love, compassion, joy, all those good things we all want. So I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense.
Let me play a moment from the film. And let's put this in the context of when all of this starts. Will, this starts in at least the sort of trajectory of the film begins in 1985. And what's interesting about that time is this is, as you put it in the film, this is the 80s. This is the me generation. And so this was this sort of countercultural effort on your part to find something that was more meaningful than what was going on in the 80s, which, of course, was that me generation. And so you're going to hear various voices, Will among them, and Julian, and there's a long litany of terrific people in the film talking about this idea of this built-in family.
I had never seen this anywhere. I was like, I have got to document this. It was the middle of the 80s and the me generation, and we wanted something different.
And then I met some of these people. They were so alive, living from their heart and playing and jumping in ice-cold rivers and hiking through the forest at night. And, oh my God, I want me some of that.
Some of them were some of the smartest, most beautiful people I'd ever met in my life.
We started it. This is what we wanted. It was our little utopia in the middle of this big, giant city.
Constantly you were being fed, like your soul was being fed with love and with inspiration and awe.
I wanted everybody in the world to experience this.
I can remember feeling so fulfilled.
I said, Dad, I want to give my life to God. And he was on the next flight out there to come get me.
The people that were there were looking for spirituality, but all of a sudden you had a built-in family.
It seems like this is the part that people forget. We're going to get to this charismatic leader, the teacher, Michelle, in a moment. People, I think, have this impression that the way a cult works is you come under the spell of this leader, and maybe that's true. But the thing that I think the film conveys, and I want you to talk about that, is the part of family, the other people involved, that you're drawn as much to that idea of community and love and connection as anything else.
And, you know, it's been really neat being out here with all the cast members because we were interviewed separately. So many of us haven't seen each other for years, some for like 9 years.
Or they don't know each other's story either.
Oh, and that's the other big one.
We're
getting all sorts of stories that I had never heard before. But it's like a little reunion. And everybody is commenting about, wow, you know what? The reason I stayed so long was for you because I didn't want to leave all you guys, all you friends, my family. And that connection, it's interesting. It's still there.
And it keeps you there, too, because there were moments when I wanted to leave and I would say, I am out of here.
Yeah, for sure.
And my best friend would be like, okay, calm down, breathe, meditate, this will go away. You'll feel fine tomorrow.
Just in your mind.
I'm like, okay, you're right. You're like, no, yeah. And it's like, okay, the next day it's like, I'm still here. You know, and a lot of people had that experience that they wanted to leave. They would go to talk to the teacher. I want to leave. 20 times, this one girl said, I think 20 times I tried to leave and he talked me out of it. And he's a hypnotherapist. He would have a therapy session with her. And so there's certain things that kept us there that we weren't really aware of. A lot of it was our support, like Chris said, our brothers and sisters. And a lot of it was his control and the way he would influence us.
Well, the cultivation of dependency.
Totally. But it's interesting also, I mean, you guys were so healthy and you were doing exercise and you were eating so well and you lived in houses and you had jobs. I mean, you weren't flakes. I mean, I think that's another sort of one of those interesting sort of stereotypes about that. You were paying for the things that you had. You had money. I mean, that was another interesting part of the twist, I think, on the story.
Yeah, no, and I lecture on a regular basis at Cal State Sonoma. And one of the things every single class of people ask me will be, you seem so intelligent. How did you get into this?
Yeah.
Everybody has that question. I think the film did a fantastic job of answering that.
That was the major question that everyone – that I try to take people on the experience so they could answer that, so it could be answered for them, because there is not one answer. And it's like that answer moves as the years go by. It keeps shifting why we stayed.
Yeah. Let me ask you about – let's talk about Michelle, the teacher. Various names throughout his life and throughout the film.
We'll use the first name we met him by. That's the first name we met him by, but it's not the last name we know him by.
Right. That's changing, as many things are, and we can get to that. But let's talk about the first time you met him, both of you. Impression.
Well, you know, that was one of the questions I asked everybody in the group when I interviewed them. What was your first impression? And it was interesting because – and I didn't use this in the film because our first impression sometimes isn't what we stick with. We ignore our first impression is what happens. And a lot of people's first impression was like, wow, this guy's so interesting and beautiful, but what a freak, or he seems like a narcissist. But that little thought in the back of your head just kind of goes like, well, you know, that's not what I heard he is. I heard he's a guru, or I heard he's this. So you negate that part of yourself that has a little intuition or insight into something.
Like, so what's that weird stare? Oh, it's okay. Right.
Yeah, you don't get it, but it takes a matter of minutes before you kind of just accept it. One girl I interviewed said the first time she went there, she was like, oh, my God, get me out of here. What are all these people? They're like all oohing and aahing. And she goes, and about halfway through the meeting, I thought, maybe this is the real deal. So something happens. Maybe it's the words. Maybe it's his voice. I mean, he studied hypnotism. I mean, he studies hypnosis. And he, you know, for anyone to study hypnosis, you must be using it.
I was going to say, I think that this is the major thing that brings people into the group is social proof. When you see 80 people following this person as a guru, they must be a guru, right? 80 people couldn't be wrong. And especially if you like those 80 people. My initial impression was that he was a little creepy. But I just looked at all the people in the audience there and they were genuinely experiencing love and expressing it.
That is so reassuring that you said that. Because you do wonder about people. I mean, and clearly people are questioning, what was the matter with you two? Why did you really get into this in the first place? But you're right. I mean, that's... And that's what's interesting about the film. It does sort of take you along to show you how it is that it works.
And you don't join the first day. I mean, I went to my first meeting. I don't even barely remember it. I walked out going, I really liked that. That's all I thought. I mean, my sister goes, my sister brought me, so she's already family. And they're like, how'd you like it? I'm like, I really liked it. And that's all. So I went again the next week and again, and pretty soon you start getting impressions. You start, you know, having a decision or you're making up your mind about something. But the first time, I don't think you make up your mind about anything.
Yeah.
Let me play another moment here. This is we'll hear various voices talking about their impressions of the teacher. And I think what was interesting about it is he seemed different from your sort of stereotypical guru in a lot of ways.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He was contemporary. He wasn't some little old man with a gray beard sitting in a dhoti. He was wearing Speedos and Ray-Bans, you know, and he was dancing and he was doing, you know, contemporary music.
He spoke four or five languages. He was amazingly humorous, witty.
Very playful, like a child. He could do something like, oh my God, I can't believe he just did that. He could dance, he was artistic, he was all those things we all wanted to be.
He was unlike anyone I'd ever met before. He encouraged me to drop all my ideas of what I thought I was supposed to be.
I finally felt like I was on the right path. I attended every meeting, every group outing we would take, and even went to Michelle's weekly individual hypnotherapy sessions called cleansings. I really felt like something important was happening in my life.
It's interesting. One thing that really does strike you right away in just seeing all of those images that you've collected over time and those initial, just how damn beautiful everybody is. Mm. Perfect physiques and clearly happy also. The idea of beauty, the physical idea, what was that about, do you think? I mean, I think that was such an interesting part of that.
Sure. Well, part of it was, I think, sort of the trickle down of Michelle's own narcissism. You know,
he was from Venezuela.
Yeah. He was very vain.
He was from Venezuela, unabashedly from Venezuela, and was not afraid of loving Miss Universe contests and loving Miss Venezuela contests.
Oh, yeah, he loves pageants.
So how he sold it to us and how we all pretty much accepted it. Here's a great example. My best friend in the group and my co-producer in the film, when she came, she had a afro and she was an artist and she wore black, just black. She was like cynical and dark. And within a year, she was wearing flower shirt and color and hair was up and she was wearing makeup. And so why? Why did that happen? And his whole approach was like, as soon as you start experiencing beauty inside yourself, right? As soon as you start feeling beautiful, you should look beautiful. You should look how you feel on the inside, outside. And so he would tell girls, wear makeup and do this and put that on. Don't wear like that. And wear a dress and put on high heels. So he wanted everyone to be pretty. So whether it was coming from his own personality, he turned it into a teaching. For us.
So there's so many mixed messages going on there in some level. On one hand, you guys are about service, taking care of people, about compassion, about putting aside the meaningless things. And yet he's wearing makeup and using false eyelashes and saying you need to work out 3 hours a day or whatever it is.
The dichotomy is
mind-blowing. Dichotomy, totally, right?
Yeah,
it's interesting. He now, here's the question that I wanted to get to, and that is whether or not what was happening was organic. It just sort of was happening, or if it was intentional on his part. Whether or not the teacher...
Was this all premeditated?
Was it premeditated?
Yeah,
or was,
well, that's the question. That is what I went back to find out. Because in my mind, that turned my head upside down and in circles to think this was all premeditated. That was the biggest trauma.
Do you think it was?
I kind of worked this into the film so the audience can come to their own conclusions.
Yeah,
I try to give
true.
As many things for people to have their own discussion about it. I have my feelings about it. What are yours?
Well, I mean, I don't want to blow a spoiler or anything.
Yeah,
I definitely
don't.
Have my feelings about it. After a conversation I had last night with we had two members show up that we didn't know were going to show up to the ex-members, rather.
Which I had to talk about.
Yeah, and it was a really moving experience. But after listening to one of their stories, because he had been around from the very beginning.
From Florida. This all started in Florida before I got there in 1985.
Wow.
So if I were to really tell the story as if I was telling a documentary about that story, it would have been before I got there.
Yeah.
So he had 4 or 5 years with people before I met him.
Now that I've spoken with him, I feel a little more certain in my opinion about it. But again, I don't want to spoil anything for the viewers.
But something beautiful did happen yesterday. A lot of ex-members who we haven't had an opportunity to talk to yet because this all happened so quickly showed up because he wanted to know what was going on for himself instead of just being afraid of the worst case scenario. And he came to look at the film. He was a brother of mine who inspired me when I was young, but he was abused. And he had the same thing happen to many of the people in the group, many of the males, before anything had happened in California or Austin. And for him to come and cry and feel that it opened up things in him that he can now talk about that he was never able to talk about, I just think that's such a great success for the film.
Yeah, and that was my major concern too, is how are ex-members going to feel about this? Because it's ultimately your story as a director.
I'm trying to tell everyone's story. It's very complicated in minutes.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
But I guess everyone will have their own idea, and we, again, we don't have to give anything away, but to the question as to whether or not he was, all right, here's my plan to get these guys to become my worshipers. I'll start by isolating them. I'll give them this extent. He didn't really did he think about it in those terms?
I'm going to jump in here. Okay. Yes, he did. Yes. All he did was read spiritual books. Okay, readers are leaders, you know, right? He read constantly. And what the books he read, he would underline them, make notes, memorize them. He's an actor. And repeat them and regurgitate them and repurpose them. We all thought they were his words, basically. But he studied from other gurus.
So this was a role he was playing.
He was. He was really playing a role because he was studying it. But he was playing a role for us to try to help us. So, I mean, if he was playing a role, we thought it was for our best interest to teach us these things. But he was borrowing this knowledge from books. And a lot of those things he learned.
One of the things that I'm really interested in my research is, and in general, is the history of thoughts and ideas. And particularly with him. And so as I was looking at him as a character and finding out pieces of his history, I investigated hypnosis, of course, and NLP as kind of a side shoot to it. And I saw just a myriad of techniques that I thought, wow, this is – that was everything that Michelle was using.
It's this – that stare – which is constant in the it is so creepy. I guess
it's invasive.
It's invasive.
It is invasive.
It's like, what is that about? But
dominance.
Idea of hypnosis. Yeah, that's really
it is. It's powerful.
Because think about it. When do we stare at each other? When we're either those prolonged eye gazes. Mm-hmm. It's either when there's intense intimacy, or when there's intense violence.
Yeah. And it's a super primal.
Yeah, primal. Exactly. Yeah. You're trying to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about this, one of these, which seems to be the kind of techniques, or certainly an experience that gives you a sense of why you would be drawn to stay. There's this experience called the Shakti, and it's not something the Buddha field made up or the teacher. I mean, it's this, just, you know, it's a Hindu principle of divine energy and. Mm-hmm.
Which he lifted from Osho.
Of course, right, exactly.
He saw someone else do it and said, I can do that.
Did he? Yeah, well, he puts his own spin on it.
Yeah.
And I want to play this moment from the film. He puts his own, he creates this ceremony, kind of this idea of this transference of energy from the master to the disciple. And it has a really profound effect. Let's play this moment because I want to get you to talk about it. Again, another moment from the film, Holy Hell.
I'll never forget the first time that I got Shakti. My body started convulsing and all these kinds of things kind of started happening.
When he touched me, I was no longer myself.
There was a profound experience where I felt a current where I felt like, oh, there's electricity happening.
And I see this sort of like flashing light.
Like lightning. Sound so loud, like a jet airplane.
That's pretty addictive.
I was experiencing an LSD-like state. Colors were moving around him. And I thought, I found it.
That was Christopher there talking about that LSD-like state. You think you understand what was going on now?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do. And what I've chalked it up to is neurochemicals. There was a study done on depression where they had people smile for 20 minutes a day. And it actually relieved... It was a really high percentage. I don't remember the exact number, but it relieved symptoms of depression, and a large number of the people even got off of medication. So we can affect our neurochemicals, and especially in groups, to make us feel things. And so basically the meditation for me was creating this euphoria. It was a love, a joy, a euphoria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much what people experience on MDMA and LSD.
Mm-hmm. And I had done MDMA, is that right? Ecstasy before in college years ago. And I was looking for that because when I first came to the group, he had said, everything you're looking for in drugs or escapism or alcohol or movies or sex, all that stuff you're trying to get out of your ego, you can't depend on all that. You have to learn how to do that organically. You have to learn how to sidestep your ego organically.
Which I'll add is probably the best thing I got out of my time.
Yeah, and I agreed
there.
With that, and I like that.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back to what you what you retain and what you ditch a little bit later in the program. Will Allen is with us. He directed and produced Holy Hell, part of the Sundance U.S. documentary competition. Christopher Johnston appears in the film. Tonight at 6 o'clock, there's going to be a screening at the Library Center Theater in Park City. There are also screenings on Thursday and Friday in Park City, and Saturday at noon, you can see it at the Salt Lake City Library Theater in downtown Salt Lake City. We have details for all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, another extraordinary story from the Sundance Film Festival. We're talking about Will Allen's film called Holy Hell. It's his personal story, really, of his experience in a spiritual community, a cult, really. It was a group called the Buddha Field, and it was led by an odd but charismatic man who goes by various names, among them Michel. Will Allen says at first he saw the potential for love and enlightenment, but then, of course, things began to change. The message got distorted, as they always seem to do in these kinds of stories. Will Allen is with us, along with Christopher Johnston, who is also in the film, a former member of the Buddha Field. So there's this, I thought this was really compelling. You were mentioning before that everyone's sort of looking for something in life, and the idea that there might be a secret, like Scientology, this is a big draw for Scientology, mm-hmm. and I won't just single them out. There are a mm-hmm. lot of sure. religious organizations that say that there is a secret, there's a thing that you can know about, and for Michelle, for the teacher, there was the knowing. Would you talk a little bit about this? This was, in some ways, nirvana, maybe, or mm-hmm. this kind of culminating moment. And he certainly manipulates this idea because he tells some and leaves some people out. But this idea that I guess this was the secret.
This was the thing we were preparing for. See, this makes this whole thing make sense. When I got there, the knowing was something that was being offered to you, but you had to be prepared for it, meaning you had to be ready to receive it. Otherwise, you could miss it.
Yeah.
So you meditate as much as you can. Years went by. I was there for 4 years, quote unquote, in my mind, preparing myself to be able to receive this so I could understand it and see it. And so he kept saying, you're not ready, you're not ready. So all of this, all the work we were doing during this period was preparing us for that. It was kept a mystery, a secret. Those who had it revealed to them would never tell you what it was. So all of us who didn't know what it was just this big carrot that mm-hmm. we wanted. And now, did the teacher, was he qualified to give this? No.
Right.
He borrowed this. I mean, he really, I will tell you a plot spoiler, which is not in the movie, and I don't mind.
Yeah.
He never had his own guru. See, but he told us he did.
That was his backstory that he told us.
His backstory was, I had a guru, I won't tell you who it was, and he gave me this experience. I'm calling it the knowing.
Yeah.
What really happened was he went to a 3-day seminar, and there was a guru, Maharaji, who would come in town and touch people and say, this is called the knowledge. And he would touch your eyes, he would touch your ears. Yes, I'm revealing this. Mm-hmm. He would touch you in places, and he'd say, this is, you know, practice this, and you can experience God this way. It's called the knowledge. Well, he took it and turned it into a verb.
Yeah, it didn't change it much.
The knowing, it's a living thing.
Yeah.
And called it his own and kept it a very tight secret. And it could only be revealed by him, and it was connected to him. And that's all we knew about it.
There was such a ceremony to that, too.
Yeah.
Was that part of it?
Well, religion's like about ceremony,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You go off into the woods. Maybe throne isn't the right word. I mean, Christopher,
no,
you carried around the
throne's the right word.
Yeah.
What?
Talk a little bit about what the ceremony was like. I mean, he plays it up, of course.
Well, it was very intense, really, actually, because you were all preparing for this for so long, and it was all built on how humble you were. Like, or were you really, really sincere? Were you really ready to give up everything to have this instead of what you think's important?
And, of course, he's the arbiter of that.
Yeah, of course.
He decides if you're ready or not. And so, you know, you're trying to please him, of course. But when it came down to it, I think it happened in 4 days. He took, you know, 20 people at a time as they all had individual moments with him where he would assess them and tell them no or yes. And out of about 80 people, 12 of us got it, you know. And that was the last knowing session we ever had, and that was in 1989. But
oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. This is one of the, you mentioned in the film, one of the things that made the knowing so intriguing was that not everyone was going to be able to
That's
receive
right. That's
it.
What made it. That's what turned it into a competition.
Now, your sister, Amy, gets you involved in the Buddha Field. And she's left out.
Yeah.
And she really resents it. I mean, even now, she's out of it, she still feels...
Because why?
Why is it that you got it and I didn't?
It's not so much about me, but for her, what that was is the ultimate rejection from God. I mean, to her, she's like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
Why has God said, you're not okay?
Yeah.
So, Christopher, is that a technique? The idea of dividing the group a little bit, giving certain people some knowledge, and is that a thing?
Yes, it is. And I don't know a proper name for it, but our producer says it best. It's a kick and a cuddle.
Yeah.
Says, so when you are not holding the status quo, you get the kicks.
Yeah.
And then when you come back into the fold, or if you're moving away and he wants to bring you back, or if you're just coming in and beginning a sexual relationship with him, you get a lot of the cuddle. But that's the manipulation, right? And even anybody in an abusive relationship experiences a similar thing. It's the push-pull. Yeah.
I wonder if you ever think, because this occurred to me, and maybe this is an element of human nature, that if you don't have certain – I mean, look, it's nice to get complimented. But if you're in an environment where someone is complimenting you constantly, and not only that, adoring you, essentially worshiping you, and you don't have a reality check.
That's right.
Doesn't it make sense that a man who is looking to have looked to as having this grand answer and was adored, wouldn't they always turn out to be that way? Wouldn't they?
Unless they had
a narcissist.
Unless they had an intense amount of integrity and an intense amount of checks and balances on their own because they care. You know, that has to be something that to me is something that's taught to you. If he had a teacher that taught him that, because there are teachers in India who are taught from lineages of how to receive and behave and how to give.
And to act like a master.
And how to behave, whatever, what you can and can't do, I'm imagining. And so he didn't have that. He never had that.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, we're not down on all gurus.
No,
it's a legitimate religious tradition.
It's a cultural. It's,
but yeah, but when you co-opt somebody else's culture – and then have no familiarity with it. You're just trying to superimpose something on it for your own gain.
He was from Venezuela, not India.
And there is a phenomena. I forget the French word for it. It was a French psychiatrist that came up with it. But it was called the madness of many. And basically what he described it as was that interplay between the narcissist and the what we used to call codependent. Currently, we look at narcissism as a spectrum of positive and negative, where the guru character, for instance, Michelle, would be on the far positive end of that spectrum. Me, when I came into the group, was on the far negative end of it, with very low self-worth, looking for a sense of self and self-esteem. And that's the marriage.
Let's talk about your own families, because this is an important part of the story. Your mom's such a pistol, Will, because as part of the process, and I'm not sure if this is always how it works, but you took on different names. You became Francesco.
I did.
And your sister, Lori, becomes Crystal.
Correct.
And is she still Crystal?
Well, she actually rejected that name, but she liked that name because so many of her new friends knew it. So she just added an A to it.
Okay.
And she calls herself Cristalla.
Got it. Because I noticed that in the film. I'm like, maybe she kept that. I don't know why she would have kept that. But anyway, and so it's you and your two sisters.
Yes.
Make this presentation to your parents that we all have new names now and we want you to call us new names. And your mom and your dad are like, nope, we're not going to do that. Would you talk a little bit about your relationship with your parents? And this idea, and Christopher, maybe we can get to this as another element. The teacher wants you to detach from your family.
Detach him.
Yeah.
He would say one of the main teachings in the group was like, if someone was very attached to their parents, like, I got to go see my mother for her birthday. Right? He'd be like, do you know how many mothers you've had? You've had many, many mothers. Where are they now? They're all gone. You need to be here with me. This is all, they have nothing to do with you anymore. And so he would kind of put it into this huge spiritual thing of like, you've had many mothers, many fathers, many children.
Yeah, you're a soul. You're not Will.
You've been here many times, all this kind of stuff.
You don't need them.
You don't need them. You've felt this way many times and it's all illusion. So, you know, you slowly start to go, yeah, you're right. or I'll see them when I see them or something like that. So, but we had a very close-knit family. My mom's Italian, and so family was always really big for us. And so I love my parents. I never not loved my parents. My mom thought he taught us not to love him. And I'm like, no, actually, we learned how to love you as you are and who you are. But, but you know, not everyone's ready to not be with their family. I was not ready, but I was so close to him, I had no choice. But he pulled people away from that so that they would not have that worldly attachment and also that identification.
There's a moment where someone says, and I think it was Vera who actually says this, she says, on some level, if you're trying to avoid all of these
triggers,
then this it makes sense to detach yourself and on some level. But yeah, it just seems inhuman if you love your folks, you know?
I told my mother in that interview, I have a good interview with her, and she was off camera yelling at me and saying, he told you to not love us. I go, no, Mom. I go, we actually had a lot of love for you. I go, we just weren't attached. And she goes, how can you love something and not be attached?
Yeah.
You can't love it and not be attached. And I was like, God, Mom, you're so right. You're right. Love involves attachment. Why would we want to detach? Why? You know, so these are the things that, you know, we have to hit ourselves on the head afterwards and going, you know, these are simple human nature truths.
Yeah. I want to play another moment. I want people to hear Michelle or Andreas or whatever his name is now. I want people to hear his voice. This is a moment where he's talking about this idea of the mask. Because I think it raises to me anyway the question of how he – not only how he perceived himself, but what – was what he was saying gibberish? Did it make sense? Was it insightful? Was there actual wisdom there despite the package? Mm-hmm. Here's Michelle from the film Holy Hell.
To be a person is to be a mask. And you never know who you're talking to behind the mask. The real person is somewhere inside that mask. You have to stand naked in front of God as He's made you in your body of light. The master only represents God on the earth. And if you can't stand naked in front of your master, you can't stand naked in front of your God. Know that.
Now, as I was listening to that, I was like, okay, let me see if that makes sense to me. And in some ways, like, yeah, it kind of does, I suppose, you know?
Stand vulnerable. You could use the word vulnerable. Sure, I mean, like raw, vulnerable. Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just – he wasn't just spouting gibberish. I mean, the things he was saying were – this was a theology. Coherent idea, right?
Yeah. This was theology. Mm-hmm. The idea, again, that you're a soul. You know, you're not a body. You're not a personality. You're this eternal thing that's had many lives, mm-hmm. and this is just one of them. And what your job is to do is to wake up to that as a reality.
And also to be open. There's a movie – we used to watch a lot of movies, and Franco Zeffirelli's Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon was my favorite ones, and that's where my name came from, actually. Mm-hmm. Francesco was St. Francis, and I was young. I looked kind of like him. My hair kind of looked like his. And there's a scene in it when, you know, St. Francis throws away all of his riches and his family and the church, and he walks naked off into the world. And that's him being like naked and with nothing in front of God, which is the world, you know. So these are big thoughts, you know, these are big things. St. Francis was someone who discarded worldly attachments, and we use that as an example. He would use that for us to help us understand it.
A metaphor for how to be.
How to be, an example. You know,
well, Christ talked about that.
Yeah. Christ
said you should leave your family.
Yeah,
I mean, he actually says that in the Bible. And what I think is interesting about that is these are not far-flung, crazy ideas. He's taking – these ideas are very similar in some
ways. Far-flung is that we're living them. See, most people read them.
Right.
And they nod yes and no, and that's it.
Yeah.
But we're living it, and that's a big difference.
Yeah,
and it really is. It's radical spirituality. Mm-hmm. You know, it's every bit as much of the commitment as somebody who decides to take monastic vows or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's Christopher Johnston. He appears in the film Holy Hell. Will Allen's with us, directed and produced. It's part of the Sundance U.S. documentary competition this year. There's a screening tonight at the Library Center Theater in Park City. That's at 6 o'clock. There are also screenings Thursday and Friday here in Park City. There's a screening in Salt Lake at the Salt Lake Library on Saturday at noon, and you can get details about all of that at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with filmmaker Will Allen. We're talking about his film Holy Hell, which is part of the Sundance Film Festival this year, the U.S. Documentary Competition. There are a number of screenings. And we'll give you details about that on our website. Christopher Johnston, who appears in the film, is also with us. Okay, so I was actually wondering how you would answer this question. Is the Buddha Field a cult?
Well, first of all, cult is such a loaded term.
It is.
Obviously, we immediately think Jim Jones, Charles Manson, that whole
Koresh.
Thing. And there's a whole spectrum of, well, levels of violence or non-violence at all in groups. So what academics are calling it now is new religious movements. Robert J. Lifton created a criteria. He was one of the first people to do work on thought reform, which is what people call brainwashing. And in 2003, he came up with his criteria. First of all, there's a leader who is the object of worship.
Check.
Members are effectively isolated from society. So that's the whole get rid of the family thing, get rid of your old friends.
Yep.
Denied or discouraged access to other points of view. So that was a big thing with us. Don't read Osho. We were specifically told not to read Osho because he's lifting stuff.
We were
from
really
him.
Only seeking guidance from him. We had vows. And the first one was only to seek guidance from him.
And this speaks to the last one, which is subjected to exploitative social influence techniques.
Can you explain that one to me?
Yeah.
Me too.
Well, absolutely. So, okay. And so when you – basically the way it worked is you have somebody who is the source of all truth. I, as a member, was in the belief that the master was the highest authority on truth of anything. I mean, it could be healthcare. It could be whether I should buy a house. I mean, anything he claims an expertise on. And I bought into that. So that's exploitative.
Yeah.
Because it's not based on any fact and because there's no sort of accountability for him to look after my best interests. He can or he can't, and it's up to him.
But exploitative also is when he has you do things you normally wouldn't do.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
Well, and that gets into some of the other stuff in the movie about the sexual relationships too.
But that's that's what that means by members, because I'm talking about not just our group. I'm talking about other groups out there who find themselves doing things that they would normally never do. And I know it's happening with people now.
And not just that they wouldn't do, but that they wouldn't have wanted to do.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the sexual part of it, and I don't want to give too much away. Sexual abuse is clearly a part of this story. But it's interesting the way he talks about sex. He says to people outwardly that we are going to transcend sex. Sex is low energy. An orgasm is a form of death. What's going on there? Why is he talking about it like that? Because this is another really interesting mixed message.
Well, one thing, it's lifted out of Eastern religious traditions and monasticism, right?
Sure.
The idea of that. But it also gives social control.
But the idea of containing your energy in your body, like he would call it, like he would say, that's like a leakage. Like that's all energy. And if you – and he, like, you know how we have different points in our body? Like we have, you know, our third eyes that are between our eyes. We have our throat. We have our heart and our cores and our tummy. And we have our lower chakra, which is our sex chakra. And we have all these things. And all of us have this. And he would say energy gets stuck down there. And to let it come out or release down there is a waste of energy. You want it to rise. And that's just kind of the wording he used. But does it help? It's like a leak of energy.
Yeah, but I don't get why he talks about sex as lower energy or not so good when he's a deeply sexual being, and everyone is. That seems so unnatural.
I know, and that's why I can't imagine it's anything other than social control, because we could have been like a full-on free love sex cult, and we still would have been following him. That wouldn't have changed anything.
The thing I saw, from my knowledge, is he was afraid of being called a cult leader. And the guru that he was studying, that he was getting all this from, was called a cult leader and was called a sex cult leader. Osho had a big sex community, and sex was very much part of their community. It was very much exercised and explored. Well, he didn't want to be labeled that, so he cut it out of everything with us. That's why it was so confusing, because he didn't want to be labeled what that other teacher was. Yet he was still practicing everything the other teacher was doing, but not talking about it.
The arc of the film is interesting. Because he's worried about being accused of being a cult leader, you go on this six-month sort of exploration to find a new place. You go to the usual places. Sedona comes up. I imagine that
Colorado
that
was
makes
in there.
Sense. Colorado was in there. You end up in Austin, Texas. for a time. Mm-hmm. And this is when really, just in terms of the arc of your story, this is when things start to really fall apart. Mm-hmm. And these accusations come out in an email from someone who leaves the group. Tax evasion and dicey professional credentials and mm-hmm. former involvement in pornography and all these weird things. The big one, of course, sexual abuse comes up. Now, Chris, this is interesting because you talk about – you had your own suspicions. You yourself had knowledge about certain things. Yet you wrote a rebuttal mm-hmm. to this email. Mm-hmm. And in the film, it's really an affecting moment in the film. We won't give too much away, but you talk about your own moral failings. Would you explain, knowing what you knew, why you would defend him and write a rebuttal about this?
Yeah, and this brings me to a text conversation that Will had with somebody who is still in the group yesterday.
Wow.
And when I was listening to that text, or looking at the text, I saw myself toward the end of my time there and how I had one foot in and one foot out. Because you're still... Well, I remember one time I was sitting there meditating with Michelle, and I was having this incredible, uplifting, internal spiritual experience. I felt so alive. And I looked across at Michelle, and I was just like, I hate this guy. You know, I had gotten to that point in my relationship with him where I just despised him. But I had to stay because I didn't know that I could experience that love, that joy without him. It's all attributed to him as if it's the master's grace that's doing your spiritual work for you.
Yeah, we didn't own any of it. It was like I was so grateful to him that I was happy.
That really comes through in the film. And you say that even that you knew something was wrong, you felt like – and in some ways it seems like, well, for you, this was the only way I have access to God. I've got to go through this creepy dude to get to God. It almost seemed like he was directly in front. And that was like, I can't access God myself. I need this person. And even if he's flawed, I've got to work through it.
Oh, right. He is Jesus, right?
Yeah. I mean,
these are the people he's comparing himself to. Right. Krishna, Buddha, Jesus.
And he's actually, you know, I don't want to jump the subject, but he's gone from doing cleansings to now calling himself a complete healer. So he's doing things with hypnosis, calling him, he's a healer. People come and get healed now from him. I spoke lately to a young man, young gay man, who left the group, which is currently in existence right now.
I want to ask you about that in a moment here, too. But I want to play another moment from the film because I thought this was really interesting.
Thank you.
This is people talking about how difficult it was to leave and what you lost, because what you lost wasn't this creepy leader. You lost a community. You lost loved ones. You lost all these friends. But you also lost a leader. And I think this is an interesting moment. Let me play this moment. I want to ask you about it.
I had just had 200 of my closest friends, who I considered to be family, gone.
It was kind of like a bomb went off. And like a village that I lived in was totally destroyed. That was the feeling it was.
I miss that community.
It was like a big death of your family all at once.
I did so much service for him and didn't worry about the future that when it was over, I had $45 to my name. I didn't have a bank account. I didn't have anything. I remembered just laying on the floor in fetal position. It was like I was dropping through this trap door. It was black and there was no bottom.
Where am I going to find that awe? Who's going to make me dance in the forest? You know, who's going to make me be willing to sing when I can't sing?
That part, this was Amy. This was
that was my sister, and it's her birthday today.
Oh,
and she's here.
Birthday, is she?
And she's singing and happy. She's very happy and singing.
But what she said was, "Who's going to do that for me?" And I thought, "Well, Amy, you don't need anyone to send you and take you into a forest. You can go yourself."
Yeah, and this was what I told her. I told her when she would say this to me over the years, I say, "You know, we learned how to do that ourselves. So if you want that, go do it. You know how to do that." She's like, "Well, there's no one else to do it with, you know." I'm like, "Well, you got to find it. I don't know."
How careful do you feel now for and how much concern do you feel now? As you mentioned, the teacher's moved. He ended up in Hawaii for a time. I think he's gone somewhere else now. So he's still the leader of a group, and there are still people that you love and are still interested in. And there's a moment in the film, I won't give up, a sort of an opportunity you have for confrontation. What's going on these days?
I feel very responsible. As I started making this movie, I took on more responsibility because I realized I had allowed so much to happen without saying anything. We were all so secretive and lying all the time. And I haven't seen anyone in my group step up and stop him. So if anyone's critical of this film, I would ask them why they haven't helped do something about this. There's nothing we can do legally, it doesn't seem like, that we have enough power to do. So I thought this was the strongest way of doing it. But I felt a lot of responsibility. I know a lot of my friends in the film brought people who were abused. They feel responsibility they can't get themselves over. So it's going on, perhaps still. Well, how do you stop something like that, you know?
And my answer to that is transparency and accountability. You know, when a leader claims the authority of God, there's got to be some sort of board council that can fire them.
Do you let me ask you this? We have less than a minute left, so not much time. Can you do it? Can you pull it off in ideal society, or will human nature always intrude? Will there always be ego and selfishness? And
I will
lust?
Tell you, there is a society I visited in Italy, in northern Italy, called Domenher. It's like 2 hours north of Geneva. And it's this Italian cult. They call themselves, they've been called a cult for 30 years, and they have no leader. And they have created this amazing society that now the UN actually visits them to learn about alternative living together.
So it can be done.
It can be done.
It can be done.
Now, I looked at them. I met them for 3 days, and I looked at them, and I honored them very much. And I know it wasn't easy, whatever they have done. I know how much personality is involved. You cannot separate your personality from a small community or a large community. You're all going to be there. So it's possible, but it takes work.
Will Allen, director and producer of Holy Hell, Christopher Johnston appears in the film. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug, so much.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes.
Our thanks to KPCW Scott Matthews and Bob Hendricks, who directed the show today. There's a screening tonight at 6 o'clock at the Library Center Theater in Park City, and various others, including one on Saturday at the Salt Lake Library. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.